Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Anna Mateo. Later, we will bring you our American history program, The Making of a Nation. But first, for many people, there is nothing better than a piece of candy. Sweets date back thousands of years to the ancient Egyptians, who ate sesame seeds with honey. In the United States, a good place to learn about candy is the True Treats Historic Candy Store in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. The store sells many kinds of treats that were popular during different periods in history. The unusual collection has everything from chocolate kisses to edible bugs. True Treats is said to be the only historic candy store in the United States. The business opened 8 years ago. It has everything from ancient Greek chewing gum to favorite candies from the 1900s. Susan Benjamin is the store's owner. She tells people interesting facts about the 400 products found in True Treats. Many visitors enjoy reading historical information written on product labels. Benjamin notes that sweets were first used to treat health problems.
Sugar were used as a medicine, and the Turkish delight was made for sore throat somewhere around the year 900, and it became very popular worldwide.
People also enjoyed some plants that were naturally sweet. They chewed on tree bark, branches, and roots.
In the mid-1800s, when kids would go and buy a root of licorice plant, and they would chew it and get that delicious licorice flavor.
One popular product at True Treats is a mix of roasted crickets and mealworms. Benjamin says these insects were once considered a sweet snack.
The crickets to me taste a little bit like sesame. And I've had ants, which some of them are a little bit bitter. They're almost tart like a lemon.
Small, round, fruit and nut chocolate candies were popular from the 1920s to 1950s with people who played card games.
They made little candies that people could pick up with their fingers in one hand and then hold the cards in the other.
Some visitors to True Treats find candy that brings back memories. Others are too young to have grown up with any of the candy in the store, like Bev Soriano.
I came here a lot as a kid, so it's a kind of lot of nostalgia, which is weird because it's in such an unfamiliar setting, yet I have so many fond memories.
Benjamin has also written a book called Sweet as Sin about the history of sweet treats.
Simone Biles has won more world championship and Olympic medals than any other American gymnast in history. She won 4 golds at the 2016 Summer Olympics. She wrote a book about her life, which was recently turned into a movie. But one thing Biles does not have is a college education. That will soon change. Biles had planned to go to the University of California, Los Angeles, after competing at the 2016 Olympics. But her very busy life made studying full-time at a university nearly impossible. Instead, she has started taking classes at the University of the People, a nonprofit online university. She is working toward a bachelor's degree in business administration. Biles, who is 20 years old, has also become the university's global ambassador. Shai Reshef, an Israeli-born businessman, set up the University of the People in 2009. The school offers undergraduate and graduate-level degree programs. Students are not required to pay to take the university's classes. The cost is free because of private and public donations. More than 6,000 educators and administrators from schools such as Yale University and New York University volunteer their time and expertise. While there are no tuition costs, students must pay $100 for each exam they take. The university estimates that getting a bachelor's degree costs about $4,060. Biles has established a special scholarship in her name to help students with those costs. It is meant to help students who have been in foster care, like Biles herself. The school's non-traditional methods work well for Biles, whose life so far has been anything but normal.
I haven't had a traditional school experience for a while, actually going into a classroom and sitting down. And the traditional way won't work for me, and I understand that, so it's okay. Online it is.
Biles was homeschooled during her high school years to make more time for her gymnastics training. Biles spoke with VOA and other media about her involvement at University of the People.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. What will most help you lead a long, happy, and healthy life? Is it making lots of money? Is it a great job that you enjoy? Perhaps it's fame. If you ask a young person, many are likely to give you one of those answers, or possibly all three. Some cultures put more importance on work and money than others. Americans can be obsessed with their jobs and making money. They might feel the need to make lots of money for education, medical care, homes, and cars. But it's not just about the money. For many Americans, self-worth is linked to our professional success or failure. Many of us spend most of our lives working, sacrificing other activities. Imagine if we could visit our older selves and ask, what would you have done differently to be truly happy? But we can't do that. We could learn about what makes people happy and what does not by studying people over the course of their lives. For almost 80 years, Harvard Medical School researchers have been doing just that. The Harvard Study of Adult Development is one of the most comprehensive longitudinal studies in history. Since 1938, it has followed the lives of a group of men from their teen years to old age. Later, the researchers began to follow their wives and children as well. The study finds that wealth, social position, and an important job title do not necessarily lead to health and happiness. Robert Waldinger is the current director of the study. He is a psychiatrist and professor at Harvard Medical School. Waldinger shared some of the findings with a Harvard Gazette reporter. He said, "The surprising finding is that our relationships and how happy we are in our relationships has a powerful influence on our health." He added, "Taking care of your body is important, but tending to your relationships is a form of self-care too." In 2015, he discussed the study in a TED Talk called "What Makes a Good Life? Lessons from the Longest Study on Happiness." The video of the talk has been viewed more than 19.5 million times. In the talk, Waldinger says, "Good relationships don't just protect our bodies, they protect our brains." He says, "Close relationships are what keep people happy throughout their lives, not money or fame. These close relationships protect people from the difficult times that come with growing older. They protect against physical and mental decline." The study suggests that strong relationships have a better chance of making a long, happy life than social class, intelligence, or even genetics. And it is not just romantic relationships. Waldinger says the relationships we make and care for throughout the years with friends, family members, and coworkers are just as important. The professor adds that strong, close relationships can experience difficult periods. They're not perfect. But he says dependability in a relationship is most important. He says people need friends they can turn to when life gets hard. In the TED Talk, Waldinger explains how the researchers collect information for the study. Researchers send a list of questions to the participants. They interview them in their homes, examine their medical records, take blood for testing, and take brain images. They talk with wives and children of the participants. The researchers also videotape the participants talking with their wives. Clark Heath, the first director of the study, led it from 1938 to 1954. The study at that time included 268 physically and mentally healthy Harvard College students. At the time, common scientific thought was that physical strength, a high social position, and a happy childhood were the strongest predictors of a healthy life. Researchers at the time also thought genetic-based elements, like intelligence, played a main part in predicting happiness or unhappiness. So early on, the research did not include examination of participants' relationships. Then in 1966, a psychiatrist and professor at Harvard Medical School joined the research team. George E. Vallant changed the direction of the study. He added a second group of participants, more than 400 teenagers from some of Boston's poorest neighborhoods. He also expanded the study to include wives and children of the participants. Vallant placed a greater importance on investigating the relationships of those in the study. He wrote that when the study began, nobody cared about empathy or attachment. But the key to healthy aging is relationships, relationships, relationships. He followed the successes and failures of the participants in their relationships, family responsibilities, and careers. He followed their recoveries as well. He led the study for more than 40 years and then wrote a book about the findings. In Triumphs of Experience, The Men of the Harvard Grant Study, he writes, "The 75 years and $20 million expended on the grant study points to a straightforward conclusion. Happiness is love." Current director Robert Waldinger ended his TED Talk with this advice from American writer Mark Twain. So we will too. "There isn't time, so brief is life, for bickerings, apologies, heartburnings, callings to account. There is only time for loving, and but an instant, so to speak, for that." And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. James Buchanan of Pennsylvania won the presidential election of 1856. He defeated John Fremont, the candidate of the newly created Republican Party, which opposed slavery. Buchanan, a Democrat, had often supported the South in the dispute over slavery. Most of the new president's closest friends were Southerners. He wrote that the North was too aggressive toward the South and should stop interfering in the slave states. Buchanan said the South had good reason to leave the Union if abolitionists continued their attacks against slavery. Jack Moyles and Stan Busby tell more about James Buchanan, and they discuss his influence in the Supreme Court ruling in the case of a slave from Missouri named Dred Scott.
As the new president, Buchanan believed he could solve the slave question by keeping the abolitionists quiet. Success would mean the end of the anti-slavery Republican Party. In choosing his cabinet, Buchanan wanted men who shared the same ideas and interests. President Pierce had tried to unite the different groups in the party by giving each a representative in his cabinet. This had not worked. It had driven the different party groups farther apart. Buchanan had served in President Polk's cabinet. He remembered how well its members worked together. He said it was the unity of this cabinet that made Polk's administration so successful.
Buchanan gave the job of Secretary of State to Lewis Cass of Michigan. Cass was 75 years old. His mind had lost its sharpness. This did not worry Buchanan, because he had planned to be his own foreign minister. The job of Treasury Secretary went to Howell Cobb, a Southern moderate from Georgia. Southerners also were named as Secretary of War, Interior Secretary, and Postmaster General. Isaac Tousey of Connecticut was given the job of Navy Secretary. Tousey was a Northerner, but he supported many policies of the South. Another Northerner, Jeremiah Black of Pennsylvania, became Attorney General. In forming his cabinet, Buchanan did not ask for advice from Senator Douglas of Illinois. Douglas was the party's leader in the Senate and the most powerful Democrat in the Northwest. Douglas believed that the Northwest should have two representatives in the cabinet. He said Cass could be one of them. But Douglas wanted one of his own supporters to be the other. Buchanan refused what Douglas wanted, and he gave the administration support to a political enemy of Douglas.
James Buchanan was sworn in as president on March 4, 1857. In his inaugural speech, the new president denounced the long dispute over slavery. He said he hoped it would end soon. Buchanan said the dispute could be settled easily by doing two things: by ending interference with slavery in states where it was legal, and by letting the people of a territory decide if they wanted slavery. Buchanan said he expected the Supreme Court to rule soon on the right of the people of a territory to decide this. He said he was sure that all good citizens, North and South, would accept the High Court's ruling.
At the time he said this, Buchanan already knew what the court's decision would be. He had even used his influence to help one member of the court to decide. The decision was made in the case of Dred Scott, a Negro slave. Scott was sold in Missouri to an army doctor who took him to Illinois and then went into the Wisconsin Territory. Scott lived in these two places for almost 4 years before he was returned to Missouri. Scott asked a court in Missouri to give him his freedom. He claimed that living in Illinois and Wisconsin, where slavery was illegal, had made him a free man.
The court agreed with Scott and gave him his freedom. But the decision was appealed, and the Supreme Court of Missouri ruled against him. Scott then took his case to a federal court. Finally, he asked the United States Supreme Court to decide if he was a slave or a free man. The Supreme Court took up the case in December 1856. The judges studied it carefully, because it raised serious constitutional questions. Scott claimed he was free because he had lived in free territory. It was free because Congress, in the Missouri Compromise of 1820, made slavery illegal in that area. Scott's owner raised the question, did Congress have the constitutional power to close a territory to slavery? Was the Missouri Compromise legal?
At first, most of the 9 Supreme Court judges had planned to give a decision without answering this question. They did not want to involve the court in this bitter dispute. The majority decided that a Negro was not a citizen. Therefore, they said, Dred Scott had no right to ask the court to hear his case. In this way, the case could be settled without deciding on the power of Congress to act on slavery in the territories. But 2 of the 9 Supreme Court judges opposed this ruling. Both were from the North. They had said they would write a minority decision. They said their decision would include a statement that Congress did have power over slavery in the territories.
Since 2 members of the court had planned to offer views on this question, the other 7 decided the majority also should do so. Of the 7, 5 were from the South. They did not believe Congress had any power over territorial slavery. The remaining 2 judges, both from the North, did not want to make what they felt would be a political decision. 1 Southern member of the Supreme Court was James Catron, a good friend of James Buchanan. Buchanan had written to him asking when the court would act on the Dred Scott case.
Catron had answered that the court would rule soon. Then he asked for Buchanan's help in getting one of the northern members of the court to vote with the five from the south. He told the president that the country would more easily accept the court's ruling if one of the northern judges gave his support. Catron proposed that Buchanan write to Justice Robert Greer of Pennsylvania. So Buchanan wrote to Greer. He told him that a strong decision in the Dred Scott case might do much to bring peace to the country. Greer agreed. He said he would vote with the five Southerners. They would rule that the Constitution did not give Congress power over slavery in the territories. All this had happened in the few weeks before Buchanan became president.
The Supreme Court finally announced its decision just 2 days after Buchanan moved into the White House. Chief Justice Roger Taney read the decision in the small courtroom in the Capitol building. The room was crowded with congressmen, senators, government officials, and newspapermen. Chief Justice Taney began reading the decision at 11 o'clock. He read for more than 2.5 hours. He said the High Court rejected Scott's claim of freedom for 3 reasons. First, Scott was not a citizen. Taney said the Constitution gave the right of citizenship only to members of the white race. Because he was not a citizen, he had no right to ask the court to hear his case. Secondly, Taney said Scott was ruled by the laws of Missouri, the state in which he lived. Missouri laws did not give freedom to slaves who lived temporarily in free territory. Therefore, said Taney, Scott was still a slave.
Then the Chief Justice took up the question of the free territory in which Scott had lived. It had become free territory under the Missouri Compromise. This was the law that Congress passed in 1820. This law kept slavery out of the northern part of the territory, which the United States bought from France. Justice Taney said Congress did not have the constitutional power to pass such a law. He said when new territory was won, it belonged to all citizens. He said Congress had the right to govern such territory until it became a state. But, he said, Congress did not have power to close new territory to any American citizen. He said the citizen from Georgia had as much right to settle in this territory with his slaves as a citizen of Maine with his horse. Taney said there was no word in the Constitution that gave Congress greater power over slave property than over any other kind of property. The only such power Congress held was the power to guard and protect the rights of the property owner. To close territory to slaves, Taney said, violated the constitutional rights of slaveholding citizens. Therefore, the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional. Congress did not have power to act on slavery in the territories.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.